Going to read this morning from Cantor 3, chapter 25, text number 34. 25 is a wonderful chapter. During the Yasapuncha weekend, we read one of those verses, 25-25. Sata Sangama Vavirya Sambhido Bhavanti Rit Karna Rasayana Kata Taj Joshimad Ash Apavarga Bhartmani Shraddha Ratir Bhaktir Anukramishati. Often quoted verse. Here that bhakti is described and the stages of bhakti, the value of sadhu sangha, and so forth. So the title of the chapter is The Glories of Devotional Service. The verse immediately preceding this morning's verse, text 34, is another wonderful verse where bhakti, devotional service, dissolves the subtle body of the living entity. Without separate effort, just as fire in the stomach digests all that we eat. The fire of digestion. Bhakti is the fire that dissolves the subtle body. Meaning, spiritual body. So the verse that follows is that stage where the subtle body, material covering of the soul, is dissolved by bhakti. So it's, at least in Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur's purport, he's saying this text 34 is describing bhava bhakti stage. Prabhupada doesn't focus like that. But so we'll discuss both. But Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur expresses as well as what Prabhupada does. Going back to text 32, shows we have the inhaled devices. another one of the glories of devotional service, which is the title of the chapter. In text 32, there's this description of bhakti as being animitta. Nimitta is a term that indicates causation. Again, Sri Brahma Sangita. There's pradhan maya and nimitta maya, upadan maya and nimitta maya, the two causal factors of maya. So yes, I'm familiar with the term from that frame of reference. The cause, as a cause of material existence, nimitta. Nimitta specifically refers to supplying the ingredients for material existence, material creation. And upadana maya is creating or providing the space or the chamber for the furtherance of material existence. Maya has these two aspects. So animitta is without cause or without motivation, without any affinity for matter. So the verse is saying, anamita bhagavati bhakti, sit here, griyasi. Mean bhakti, sit here. Bhakti is beyond liberation. Siddhi, Prabhupada is translated here as salvation. And griyasi is better than, or beyond. So we're going to hear about that in Prabhupada's purport. This 34 is expanding on 32. How is it that one of the glories of devotional service is panchakurushartam? the fifth goal, beyond Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha, beyond Moksha. That's one of the glories of devotional service. And therefore, those that are engaged in devotional service look upon liberation as insignificant. It's a happiness beyond that happiness. It's the real happiness of the soul, whereas the happiness of Brahman realization is defined by negation, the termination of material misery. Yay! But then, what's the positive happiness of the soul? The positive happiness of the soul is not yet attained. The soul's connection with the Supreme Soul in loving service, that happiness of love, is missing. So it's beyond. That's what 34 is saying. Amrita bhagavati bhakti siddhir griyasi. Bhakti is beyond siddhi. Perfection. The perfection of liberation, the perfection of oneness with Brahman. So that's a glory that in text 34 is now going to be expanded or elucidated further. Naikatmatam me sprihayanti kechin matpada seva abhir rata mad iha nayom yato bhagavata prashaya sabhajayante mama purushani. A pure devotee who is attached to the activities of devotional service and who always engages in the service of my lotus feet never desires to become one with me. Such a devotee who is unflinchingly engaged always glorifies my pastimes and activities. So it's a two-page report, and I'll just two paragraphs, and the third paragraph is the longest. The first of the three paragraphs. There are five kinds of liberation stated in the scriptures. One is to become one with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, or to forsake one's individuality and merge into the Supreme Spirit. This is called ekatmatam. The devotee never accepts this kind of liberation. The other four liberations are, so this is a quiz question. I'll recite what Prabhupada says, and then someone can raise their hand and say, what's the Sanskrit term? So there are four kinds of Vaishnava liberation. To be promoted to the same planet as God by Kunta. Samokya. You didn't raise your hand. To associate personally with the Supreme Lord. Samokya. To achieve the same opulences as the Lord. Sharsti, right. And to attain the same bodily features as the Supreme Lord. Sarupya. And the other is Sanyajya. So those are the five. So there's one that devotees reject, four that devotees may accept, and the teaching of Lord Chaitanya is the devotees reject those two. Meaning, I mean, if Krishna wants one to do this or that, they don't reject whatever Krishna wants. The meaning is, they're not aspiring for, they're not chasing a carrot of, or wishing, you know, to attain, you know, doing service so I can get that. If Krishna wants that, so that will come. a pure devotee, as will be explained by Kapila Muni, does not aspire for any of the five liberations. That's the prophet says right there. He especially despises as hellish the idea of becoming one with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Sri Prabodhananda Saraswati, a great devotee of Lord Chaitanya, said, Kaivalyam Narakayate. Naraka means hell. Narakayate, it's like hell. Kaivalya, Narakayate. Kaivalya is merging. Kevala Advaita. Kevala Advaita is the technical term of what Shankaracharya taught. Absolute monism. Kevala Advaita. Absolute monism. Ours is Kevala Bhakti. His is Kevala Advaita. So, Kaivalya Narakayate. Becoming one with the Supreme? Hellish. Why? No service? No love? Hellish. Yeah, but your miseries will be gone. Oh, that's hellish. Give me whatever it is. I just want some service. I want a loving relationship with Krishna. Put me in a straitjacket and bound and gag me and blindfold me and put me in a padded cell and I'm going to be happy? Come on. Hellish. As Prabhupada is saying in the first sentence of the second sentence of the purport, forsaking one's individuality. Well, individuality gets me in trouble, so I don't want it. No individuality. My goodness. And please remember, that's the aspiration of impersonalists and monists, or impersonalists and nirvishesha shunyavadi, voidists. Literally, that's their objective. A little spin out, but because I go to China, I thought it would be good for me to learn a little bit what Buddha's teachings are, and there's like lots of variegatedness amongst those who say this is Buddha's teaching, no, that's Buddha's teaching, no. But the popular form of Buddhism, most popular form of Buddhism in mainland China and in some other parts of Southeast Asia, is they call it something like Promised Land Buddhism, something like that. And that's not the title, something in that genre. And their idea is, if you're a good Buddhist, you go to the, they even call it Western, no, Eastern Land of Bliss, that's what, Eastern Land of Bliss, something like that. And that's a place that's within this material creation, and when you go there, there's one of the features of Buddha waiting for you. And so it's a land of bliss, blissful, blissful, blissful. No, not like this. So it's, but it's beyond. It's not a heaven. It's a land of bliss. And there you get trained up how to enter into nothingness. If you're really good. So to go from misery to somethingness to nothingness. And that's the objective. Because the teaching here is very similar to Bhagavad Gita or anything Vedic, which is the phrase is desire is the source of misery. So what's the goal? Become desireless. Zippo. Shunya. Nada. Like, you know, just wipe it out. And then what's that? Nothing. And then you enter into nothingness. they no more misery, because no more desire. And then it's like a trick, because how do you then desire to have no desire is a desire? So then you're supposed to like go beyond the desire to have no desire. And then you just, you know, there's nothing. It's a sleight of hand, by the way, because there's no such thing. Prabhupada said it this way: there are two things, Krishna and Krishnas, and there's not a third thing. There's no void in all of the creation of God. Very simple. Because if there was a third thing, then there's something outside of the purview of Krishna. But there's no such thing. I mean, there's Akash, there's space, but that's an energy of Krishna. It's a, one can enter into that. And there's the Brahmajyoti, but one can enter into that. But it's Krishna's. It's not a third thing. The conception of nothingness is smoke. It's not real. It's another, you know, so how it's another illusion, another creation of mind, born of frustration, just as we know from Bhagavad Gita. That nice verse, Dhitaraga Bhaya Krodha. So born of Krodha, or anger or frustration, people come up with impersonalism and voidism, because they don't like the suffering of material existence. So what's the alternative? Not knowing the shelter of the personality of Godhead through loving devotion to Him, then it's make this zero. And that, you know, there's different language that says it, but it's the same thing. As impersonalism is self-covered Buddhism, without going into the technical detail, that one can lay out the teaching that Buddha gave in the Sanskrit language that he used, and then you hold up right next to it, or right below it or something, the language that Shankaracharya used, and it's the same formula, just different terms. And so instead of saying it's nothingness, he said it's Brahman. But the idea of becoming one with Brahman is what? As Prabhupada is saying here, you forsake your individuality. But that's not the constitutional identity of the soul, fortunately. So it's covered Buddhism. What he did was, as Buddha rejected the Vedas and came up with this, you know, become nothing notion, Shankaracharya, on the wave of people's acceptance of become nothing, he said, no, you have to accept the Vedas, and it's not that you become nothing, you become one with Brahman. Just use Vedic language to basically the same thing. And it's an interesting subject, if you like scholarship, to like look at the comparison between the two. So the Kaivalyam Narakayate, the happiness, quote, the happiness of becoming one with the Supreme Lord, which is aspired for by the Mayavadis, is considered hellish, exclamation point. That oneness is not for pure devotees. And that's explaining what's in the verse. Na eka atmatam. Na eka atmatam. Eka, one. Atmatam. There's oneness of the Atma. I don't know if any of you know Subhas from Los Angeles, the temple president for like umpteen years, number one in book distribution in America. and our BBT trustee for North America. So he has two other brothers, and one of his brothers also lives in Los Angeles community, and his name is Naikatma. And I was always wondering, what does that mean? Now here it is. Na Ekaatma. Never that. Never merging. So that's a negative way of saying yes to bhakti. No to merging. Okay, so second paragraph. There are many so-called devotees who think that in the conditioned state, we may worship the personality of Godhead, but that ultimately there's no personality. Semicolon. They say that since the absolute truth is impersonal, one can imagine a personal form of the impersonal absolute truth for the time being, but as soon as one becomes liberated, the worship stops. You familiar with that? The teaching of Shankaracharya. Sure, you like bhakti, no problem. Do bhakti. And take this deity, there's five in the list of the hit parade favorites. Try this one, that one, the other one. The names are there. But, at the end, when you realize that you are Brahman, you don't need that worship anymore. You literally, they have ceremonies where they take the deity in procession and throw him in the ocean. Yes. Previously, like many, like when Prabhupada was present so many years ago, to go from the Mayapur temple to take bath in the Ganga, if you go out the main gate, there weren't all those shops. There weren't any shops. Now it's like disgusting. But no shops. But then there was the Bhakti Siddhanta Road, and then like the steep embankment to go down. And then, the Ganges would shift each year, the flow, the current. So one year it was quite a far distance, several hundred yards through fields. So the Prabhupada wanted to go take bath in the Ganges. So the devotees went with him, and there was this steep embankment. So one of the tall American devotees held his arm up like this so Prabhupada could lean on his arm as he climbed carefully down the embankment to get to the flat area. And when he got to the bottom, Prabhupada pushed his arm away. And the devotee recoiled and thought, maybe I offended Prabhupada, I don't know what I did wrong. And Prabhupada immediately spoke, this is impersonalism. The devotee takes assistance from his guru in order to become liberated, and when liberated, he throws his guru away. Because it's just a means to achieve an end. The worship, bhakti, sure, do bhakti, and then once you realize you're God, who needs God? You're God. Who needs a guru? Throw the guru away, throw God away, you're God. And that's the teaching. So, and such people say, without naming the names, besides, Sringeri Math in South India, there are organizations today that say, yes, we practice bhakti, we do this one, we have no discrimination, or we don't discriminate against this one, that one. Yeah, we do bhakti too, and they'll scratch a little bit. What's below the surface? Impersonalism. Check it out if you come across one of those. Ask them, simple question, what's the ultimate goal? Well, they may not tell you. But if you scratch a little bit further, it's impersonalism. Becoming one with the Supreme. As it's being described in the purport here. this is what Bhaktivinoda Thakur and Bhaktisiddhanta call the puntanas of this world. False teachings and false teachers and luring innocent aspirants of spiritual life, you get a punch in the nose instead of the embrace of Krishna. That is the theory put forward by the Mayavadi philosophy. Actually, so here's another point, interesting point. Actually, the impersonals do not merge into the existence of the Supreme Person, but into his personal bodily luster. I mean, you know, the rhetoric has become one with God. But actually, it's not one with God or the Supreme Person, it's his Brahmajyoti. Although that Brahmajyoti is not different from his personal body, that sort of oneness, parentheses, merging into the bodily luster of the personality of Godhead, is not accepted by a pure devotee. Why? Because the devotees engage in greater pleasure than the so-called pleasure of merging into his existence. The greatest pleasure is to serve the Lord. The devotees are always thinking about how to serve him. They're always designing ways and means to serve the Supreme Lord, even in the midst of greatest obstacles of material existence. You've braved your way through the snow and stuff to tell you about Krishna. Okay, so that's... He's not done with the Mayavadis yet, though. True to his prana mantra. Nirvishesha Suryavadi Pasyatyadi Satarine. Paragraph 3. The Mayavadis accept the description of the pastimes of the Lord as stories. But actually, they are not stories. They are historical facts. Pure devotees accept the narrations of the pastimes of the Lord not as stories, he says it forwards and backwards, but as absolute truth with capital letters. The words Mama Purushani, that's from the Sanskrit of the verse Mama, my, Purushani. Purushani is translated as glorious activities. Purushani is glorious activities. These words are significant. Devotees are very much attached to glorifying the activities of the Lord, whereas the Mayavadis cannot even think of these activities. According to them, the absolute truth is impersonal. Another one sentence. Without personal existence, how can there be activity? Common sense, right? Without personal existence, how can there... So, if their presumption is ultimately, there's only one thing. Brahman. So, as soon as you hear activity, that's Maya. So, we're not interested in Maya, we're interested in Brahman. So, if we want to, like, attract people to Brahman, then we'll take the activities of Krishna and interpret them. Oh, well, it's only there to teach us something, and this means that. And that means something else indicates something else, and others is Brahman. I attended a home program once. A Bengali family was the host, older family. So they invited their other, you know, Bengali friends. I wasn't really prepared. I should have been. next time I will be. At the end, it was sort of, I thought, okay, let's do something simple because these people probably don't know the basics. So we spoke the basics, and at the end, first question, Earl Duran said, could you give some interpretation of that verse, please? And I understood what it meant, because that's what they're used to. They're used to this means that. Not this means this. That means that. This means that. You know, and that's the intellectual fun or, you know, attraction. Oh, you can really interpret nicely. This means that. Whoa, that was good. That, you know what I mean? Encore, encore. So I just flatly said, you know, we take Bhagavad Gita as it is. We are, we are our seatbelt fastened. We don't go up and running around and, you know, interpreting things. We just take Krishna's, when Krishna knows what he means, and Krishna knows how to say what he means. And he says it. That's what it means. Like, you know, the pastime in Chaitanya Charitamrita, well, even a great Vaishnavacharya, Balava, wanted to give some interpretation of Krishna's name. Lord Chaitanya was very displeased. I don't know any game, any meaning besides Nanda Nandana, Yasoda Nandana. I don't know any other meaning. Didn't want to hear it. Interpretation of the name or the interpretation of the teachings. This means this, as it is. So, the pastimes of Krishna, they're factual history. It's not stories or allegories or mythology or, you know, teaching people lessons of life through. There are texts that are like that. But not the Bhagavatam. He goes on, the impersonalists take the activities mentioned in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, and other Vedic literature as fictitious stories, and therefore they interpret them most mischievously. They have no idea of the personality of Godhead. They unnecessarily poke their noses into the scripture and interpret in a deceptive way in order to mislead the innocent public. Well, putting it pretty bluntly, the activities of Mayavad philosophy are very dangerous to the public. And therefore, Lord Chaitanya warned us never to hear from any Mayavadi about any scripture. They will spoil the entire process, and the person hearing them will never be able to come to the path of devotional service to attain the highest perfection, or will be able to do so only after a very long time. And there is one more paragraph. It is clearly stated by Kapila Muni that bhakti activities, or activities in devotional service, are transcendental to mukti. That's from text 32. If you remember. Anumita Bhagavati Bhakti Siddhair Griyasi. Griyasi is better. Explicit. Not this means that. It's explicit. Bhakti is better than mukti. Text 32. This is called Panchama Purushartha, the fifth goal. Generally, people engage in the activities of religion, economic development, and sense gratification, and ultimately they work with an idea that they're going to become one with the Supreme Lord, Mukti, but Bhakti is transcendental to all these activities. Almost done. The Srimad Bhagavatam, therefore, begins by stating that all kinds of pretentious religiosity is completely eradicated in the Bhagavatam. Dharma Pramitita Kaitavotra. paramo nirmatsaranam satam, etc. So, pretentious religion. Dharma projita kaitava kaitava. Prabhupada gave up a strong definition. Cheating religiosity. Note that that's a contradiction of terms. Cheating religiosity. Where the cheating is the real ultimate benefit of the soul is concealed. So one should be very cautious about that, or rather hear Srimad Bhagavatam very carefully, and then when other less complete teachings, something that teaches Dharma for the purpose of artha, for the purpose of kama and then moksha, one can understand them correctly. Ultimately, that's for elevation through the lower modes of nature to the higher modes of nature, to help one by accepting those teachings. Persons who have such a strong affinity for material elevation are in contact with the Supreme Lord by accepting those teachings. And so there's benefit there. Modest, but spiritual benefit. And it makes it then, at least in terms of contamination, less contamination, and thus it means theoretically easier to accept bhakti. Like, it's easier to ignite dry wood than wet wood. Like that. So it's making the wet wood dry. The Bhagavatam is especially meant for pure devotees. Of course, it's also meant for us who aren't pure devotees, but would like to become dry wood at least, and then ignite. We're always engaged in Krishna consciousness and the activities of the Lord, and always glorify these transcendental activities. Pure devotees worship the transcendental activities of the Lord in Vrindavan, Dwarka, and Mathura, as they are narrated in Srimad Bhagavatam and other Puranas. The Mayavad philosophers completely reject them as stories, but actually they are great and worshipable subject matters, and thus they are relishable only for the devotees. That is the difference between a Mayavadi and a pure devotee. So just some concluding parts of this. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur said this yesterday evening, say it again. I like Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur and his commentaries. They're very deeply filled with rasa or mellows of appreciation of loving exchanges with Krishna. So in this verse, what he sees and expresses in his purport is Kapila Dev is speaking about Bhava Bhakti, and he goes into the Bhava Bhakti topic. So from the previous verse, it's bhakti dissolves the subtle body. So the material mind, material intelligence, false ego dissolve. Then what? Ecstatically, that's like we that earlier verse, then bhakti begins. Yes? We're discussing that in Chicago. So that's text 25. Yeah. This satam prasangam avadhirya samgidho. I'll read the translation. In the association of pure devotees, discussions of the pastimes and activities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is very pleasing and satisfying to the ear and heart. By cultivating such knowledge, one gradually becomes advanced on the path of devotion, of liberation, and thereafter he is freed and his attraction becomes fixed. And then the last curious sentence, then real devotion and devotional service begin. Like, what happened before that stage is, what's that called? It's sadhana bhakti. That's what it's called. But real devotion, we know from Rupa Goswami, is anyadi rasa cha shunya. No other desires. We're not there yet. So, where there's no other desires, that's bhava bhakti and prema bhakti. So that's what's being discussed according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, where anumita, without motive for something material, where there's no motive for something material, anyavilashatushunyam, jnanakarmajanavratam, that's what bhakti is. Now the rest of that verse, anukulina krishnanushilana, is Rupa Goswami says, where one is anushilana, one is cultivating that from our present position, that's bhakti, that's sadhana bhakti. To get us to where? The bhava and prema bhakti. So that's what he's saying in his commentary. This verse, 34, is speaking about the glories of bhava bhakti and prema bhakti. So those of you that are familiar with nectar devotion, think about it for a moment. Chapter 1, characteristics of pure devotional service, is chapter 1. And there's 6 items mentioned. And the first 2 correspond with sadhana bhakti. What are those first 2? First 2 are what's the Sanskrit? Yeah, thank you. Kleshakti and Shubhada. Kleshakti, the kleshas, the sufferings are gone, are eliminated through sadhana bhakti. Very quickly. And Shubhada, the beginning of all auspiciousness, that's the awakening of devotion, just through sadhana. That's the all, that's the, as the beginning of all auspiciousness, then as it becomes matured. There's 2 others, that awakening of transcendental happiness, this bhava. So, and I can't remember the other one, in the prema stage, it derides even the conception of liberation. That's prema. So that's within this verse. They're not interested. And then this now I'm describing from Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary. He says there's 4 items in this verse that are describing the glories of devotional service performed in the bhava stage. So one of those items in chapter 1, the awakening of transcendental happiness. So it's in the verse, there's a happiness that's beyond Brahmananda, which is what that verse 32 is saying. Griyasi bhaktir siddhir griyasi, that happiness is so great, there's no attraction for the promise of happiness by becoming liberated. The devotee's already liberated. According to Bhagavad Gita, the devotional service is performed from the liberated platform. Brahma-bhuta prasanatma na sochachina kamsati samak sarvesha bhuteshu mad bhaktim labhate param. Means purport, Prabhupada explains, devotional service is executed from. Bhakti is emanating from and within. It's a liberated platform. It's non-karmic. Not bondage. There may be the modes of nature operating because we're still contaminated, but bhakti isn't of the modes of nature, our consciousness maybe. But by being in contact with bhakti, that's the internal potency. One becomes elevated and freed from the modes of nature in course of time and with proper application of the process. The second thing he says is, in the verse, is matpada seva. So, in spontaneous service unto the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord, with all one's senses, free from karma and gyan. This is what he says in the purport. So, free from karma and gyan is again this animita, without motivation. Because karma and gyan are motivations. So he's describing that bhakti, which when performed, the subtle body dissolves, one still utilizes one's senses fully in the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord's service without motivation, animitta, without trying to achieve something. That's the bhava stage. And then there's this word abhi, A-B-H-I, like abhinandana or like that. Abhi means in reference to scripture. Even in the bhava bhakti stage or the spontaneous devotional service stage, one does not neglect the scripture ordinarily, unless, according to nectar devotion, unless there's some extreme spontaneous state is experienced, and then one pushes aside the regulations of scripture in favor of the expression of the ecstatic devotion. But otherwise, on the spontaneous stage, externally one continues to perform devotional service as a regulated bhakta performs. But internally, there's something else going on. It's ecstatic love. So that's Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur is saying that's the second of the four indications. And the others are quite obvious. Mad iha means desire, like iha yasya harer dasye karmana manasa gira, another verse, nikilapyasi vasta sujivan mukta sa uchate. Iha is a bit, there's many words for desire, that's one of them. So mad iha, there's an overwhelming, this is Vishwanath, overwhelming desire for tasting the sweetness of my beauty. That's madhiha, he's just unpacking it. And other features of Krishna, his the stimulations of ecstatic love, he mentioned last night, udipans, Krishna's beauty, Krishna's flute, Krishna's pastimes, Krishna. One's ecstatic love is stimulated. Mad iha. And the bhava stage, where there's no longer material mind and false ego and contamination. Mad iha. One desires overwhelmingly for those things. And as a result, there's no other desire. One loses an attraction for paltry things, pale, paltry things, which to one who doesn't have that experience, like when one's bhakti becomes weakened, then those things become important again. Material attraction starts to consume and, you know, fill our thoughts, and, you know, we may chase after them and become entangled again. But if bhakti is strong, and bhava bhakti is such that there's no attraction for anything else, the happiness is so great. The hankering is insatiable. It just carries one inexorably towards Krishna. And then the last part, Mama Purushani, already mentioned in Prabhupada's purport, where the nectar of Krishna's pastimes, he gives the example like Krishna's lifting of Govardhan Hill, or Mother Jasoda binding Krishna, and any of Krishna's pastimes. Relishing the nectar of Krishna's pastimes is the symptom of one on the Bhava Bhakti stage. You know, materialists, what's their happiness? Well, get some money, spend the money, go places and see places and do things, and controlling and, you know, chasing that kind of thing. The devotee has another happiness, relishing Krishna Katha, and they can't get enough of it. And whatever spare time, discretionary time, they find the time to expand. They're investing in those things. And so even when they're doing their ordinary things, they're doing those things internally, if not externally, and, you know, through sound vibration, engaging with others in that activity. It spontaneously comes out, or is spontaneously bubbling within with great happiness. They don't want to leave that, but there may be duties to do, so you do your duties and do that internally. He adds, while offering praise. So it's that's the formality, offering praise. Not in the sense of duty, but in the sense of holding in high regard. But even in the intimacies of Lala Vrindavan, where, you know, let's say, like Cowherd Boys. There's different groups of Cowherd Boys, and some of them are older. And so they have a sense of protection of Krishna, their dear friend. They carry sticks in case somebody wants to bring harm to Krishna. They're not going to get near Krishna. We're going to... Then there's other Cowherd Boys that they're just fearless, like the Agasura demon. They saw, oh, what's this? Big cave? Yeah, there's some big cave. Hey, maybe it's a big serpent lying in the road. Smell that fishy smell. But anyway, Krishna always protects us. Let's go. They have complete confidence in Krishna's protection. They're just enjoying. Whatever happens, they're going to be protected by Krishna. They have full confidence in that. And Krishna always protects them. Okay. So it's true also in the unfolding of Krishna's pastimes, what to speak of. I mean, we're speaking of our stage, you know, here on earth as we're practicing devotional service, and then through very careful execution of devotional activities, following Rupa Goswami's teaching, the bhava stage may come, and the attraction for Krishna is spontaneous, but still there's great regard for the devotees, when to speak of Krishna, even when there's intimacy of love. Sri Dham, the boys wrestle. Whenever I read this in Nectar Devotion, I think of a godbrother named Kirti Dave, who used to just laugh and laugh and laugh, and he'd repeat over and over again this passage from Nectar Devotion, where Sri Dham would say, oh Krishna, what kind of big man are you? We always get defeated in wrestling. And so you have to carry me on your shoulders. What kind of big man are you? But it's not like you're small and I'm big. It's just a kind of love. And you know, it's Krishna's the object of love. And Krishna enjoys that kind of exchange of love with his devotees. So it's not a disrespect, or I'm great and Krishna's not great. Although the language is like that, it's literally an exchange of love. Okay, so any comments or questions?
Yesterday you were about to answer a question about the relationship between deity worship and Harinam, and I was just wondering what's like, you know, how does deity worship help Harinam, and how does Harinam help deity worship?
Well, that was the question she asked, right?
Yeah.
But she just asked, well, is there a relationship? And I said, yes. It wasn't like, what is that relationship? Okay, so now you're asking, let's...
Sure.
Okay. We'll say two things. The nine categories of bhakti are sequential. At least the first two start the other seven, Shravanam, Kirtanam. So that the Kirtanam part is essential. And Kirtanam begins with Shravanam. Before we do the Kirtanam part, we do the, what are you going to Kirtan about? Something that you heard. So they go together, hearing and chanting. And then with that hearing and chanting, then some attraction based on the hearing and chanting for service. And service to what? Or to who? So service to Krishna in the form of Krishna. So then deity worship, you can say, is a byproduct of, or a consequence of, hearing and chanting. Kind of like what Prabhupada did at the beginning, the Hare Krishna movement. There wasn't deity worship, there wasn't even pictures, just kirtan, and then class. And from that, purification, attraction for Krishna, and then pictures, and then eventually further purification, deities. So archana is one of the nine processes of devotional service that begins with hearing and chanting. And then when deity worship is being performed, it's accompanied with hearing and chanting. Like, not like I graduate from hearing and chanting and I move on to deity worship. Jiva Goswami writes in Bhakti Sandarbha that while it is said that any one of the nine processes of bhakti is sufficient for achieving perfection, it's like this very elaborate presentation on, they must be accompanied with kirtan or chanting as the yoga dharma. So when do we think about it? When we do deity worship, mangalarti, kirtan, deities are worship, curtain opens, kirtan, you know, before and after. And so the essence in one sense is the kirtan, and the deity worship is, you know, inconsequential, but it's another aspect of, as the deity form of the Lord is one of the transcendental forms of the Lord, the holy name is the sound vibration form of the Lord, and our access to deity worship done properly is through sound vibration. So that's the connection. One leads to the other. And of the of the nine processes, hearing and chanting most important, whether one has deity worship or not. Now, just one other thing is, Prabhupada explained there's Pancharatrika Vidhi and Bhagavat Vidhi, the rules and regulations of deity worship. That's Pancharatrika Vidhi. And there's Bhagavat Vidhi, the rules and regulations, or the procedures of Bhagavat Katha. And they go well together. One enhances the other. Deity worship, combined with hearing and chanting, Bhagavad Katha purifies one's existence, and deity worship further purifies one's existence. So one helps the other. But it's, at the same time, it's still proper to say, one is the support of the other. That hearing and chanting is the support of the other, without which deity worship is incomplete. Hare Krishna. Yes?
One thing in the verse was coming about this point about forsake of individuality.
Yeah.
And one thing that I was relating with was that how we hear this concept of impersonalism is so much implicitly present in the society on different names, but that's what it's
under. Sure.
So even this concept of forsaking individuality, I was connecting with parenting and even teaching as teachers, that it's far more easy to have a cookie cutter approach where we don't really acknowledge so much of the individuality of the dependent. And then this it becomes more functional at some levels to have that kind of a structure where we are looking for a project and an outcome and not really looking at the individuality of the individuals and nurturing that. And my question is, I was just becoming more and more aware that how this aspect of impersonalism is connected with this thing of training, which is the individuality of the person.
Okay. It's a comment.
And also just I don't know how to put that in words, but that was kind of awareness and kind of, is that a caution for oneself?
Is that a what?
Caution for oneself, that being aware of that it's so wide from waiting, that one even has to be conscious for our own self to
sure.
some level protect our own individuality in practice.
But, you can be cautious, but on the other hand, what are you going to do about it? Say it the other way around. Attention, rather than caution, attention can go to recognizing one's own individuality. And then in turn, the individuality of others, and giving space and accommodation for the individuality of others. But you can't just go around, doing that with others if it's not happening within. But that individuality, caution, another caution is, that sense of individuality can just be, one's particular variety of material contamination. Until we're on the purified stage, my individuality is my false ego, my contaminations, my likings and dislikings and, stuff, the coverings, and that's me. So that's another risk about attending to or focusing in on one's individuality. And therefore, just in terms of training, there are standards. It's not exactly, one size fits all, but there are standards. And the standards are there for a purpose, for purification, so that we can discover our individuality. Now we'll go back down again and say, within those regulations, there's varna and ashram. And it's not one size fits all, but there is varna, and there's variegatedness even within the four. There's different types of brahmanas. There's different types of kshatriyas. the different types of Vaishyas, the different types of Shudras. So recognizing even, you know, the material aspects of those things, they are to be submitted to the codes of Scripture. And that's not, you know, impersonalism, it's a means of purification. But I don't want to spin out on this, but I was very interested in Shivra Maharaj's conception from his experience in New Vrishadam about the role of Varnashram within ISKCON, because there are some that say Varnashram is for those who are not Vaishnavas. You know, we do Bhagavat Dharma, and Varnashram Dharma is for those that don't do Bhagavat Dharma. And there's others, like Shivram Maharaj, that says, well, when one comes to the purified stage where there's not material contamination, one can simply follow Bhagavat Dharma and not heed Varnashram Dharma. But as long as there's contamination, and he puts it this way, I know for myself, I'm not beyond contamination, so I need to regulate myself according to Varnashram. And then in growing a community over here in Hungary, where we're all living very closely together and off the land, we're very keenly aware of differences and the need to regulate those differences by Varnashram. And then from that, it goes into his view. It's not what everyone shares, but his view is on this topic of female Diksha Gurus. When someone is on that Bhagavat stage, beyond material contamination, no problem. And if one isn't, then one should be regulated according to the codes of Varnashram. Is there a possibility of exception? Definitely. But the exception is an exception, not, you know, where we are. He has pretty strong convictions in that. So, well, back to your question. What about individuality? Well, we can recognize the condition types, and then, you know, higher is the transcendental type. But even with the condition types, those can change as one becomes purified. So what one's need for individual expression at the beginning stage might not be the same at the higher stage. And there's some merit in the beginning stage to the principle of Pranipat, submission. And it's not impersonal. It's a volitional choice to submit to something that may not feel me. And you've heard me say this probably 10 times. When you know, the first service I was given was washing pots. And I was thinking, that's not me. But it was good for me to, like, get rid of that, at least one piece, one little sliver of piece of false ego. Instead, accepting the position that, let me just do what Krishna wants. And that wasn't my individuality, it was submission. It wasn't impersonal, it was to Krishna. So the conclusion is best to work under the guidance of a qualified person who can see, you know, what will help the individual, whether it's the transcendental or the regulated or the just, you know, let it hang out and just, you know, be an individual. Of course, you know, the goal is to come to the stage of fully immersed in Krishna service, whatever he wants. That's a very elevated position. So he can do it the year he wants. And that's not impersonal. It's very personal. But whatever he likes. So there's a range. It's quite flexible of what being personal means. And best to work on that under guidance. Yes.
We read in a purport last week in our Bhagavatam class at Krishna House that the last snare of Maya is this desire to be one with Krishna.
Okay.
And it was asked to me if that is something that a devotee also confronts. It seemed like maybe we've gotten over that since we're worshipping Krishna and we have so much gyan that Krishna is Bhagavan. And I wasn't satisfied with my own answer, so I wanted to.
Well, the last snare of Maya, of wishing to become one with the Supreme, it doesn't necessarily apply to each and every individual. You know, other individuals may have other garden varieties besides that one. One could argue that, well, ultimately that means the other garden varieties means wanting to become Krishna anyway. So that wanting to become Krishna in an egoistic sense is not identical with aspiring for Sahaja Mukti. It's just gross illusion. And one can become covered with gross illusion in that way, being the enjoyer in Krishna's position. So something like, anyway, a gross materialist or Sahajism or something like that. So like a Sahaja is not thinking Sayuja Murti. They're just thinking sense gratification in the name of some hallucination in relation to Krishna. But not necessarily. But it means everyone's going to face that ugly beast. I want to become one from it. Yes.
Sometimes we see this impersonalist viewpoint moving it or being raised in Bhaktivinoda groups.
Okay.
And one young boy made the comment that Srila Prabhupada doesn't pull any punches when he's discussing his philosophy. I'm trying to figure out, how do we handle that? Should we squash it aggressively or let the concepts of bhakti kind of lure them to the higher things? Obviously they don't have the strength to fight as strongly as Srila Prabhupada has. How to deal with that when it comes up in our preaching environments?
It all depends on the circumstance, the person, the individual, yourself, the group. I'll say the same. So here's like two polar opposites, and then there's everything in between. Hammer persuasion and a hammer. When it comes out, that's the hammer. And then, hammer persuasion. Like Bhaktivinoda the Thakur's approach. Let's take a look at that. Now, where does that lead us to? Does that match the real condition of the soul? Is it possible for a time living entity to become the supreme living entity? And what does it mean to become one with the supreme? Like this little one sentence, actually they don't become merged with the supreme person, they become merged with the Brahma Jyoti. And what does that merge with the Brahma Jyoti mean? What is the Brahmajyoti? It's packed up, numerous, numberless living entities where their individuality is suspended. Then there's the Vrinda Mandaraj metaphor. It's like two football teams and they're on the 1 yard line, and they give the ball to the fullback, who just kind of like merges with everybody else and tries to cross the finish line. That's the Brahmajyoti. Football, sports metaphor. So that's what the Brahmajyoti is. And it's not, now, is that the goal? Or somebody else was giving me, it used to be, once upon a time, it was one of the things for college students to see how many college students they could pack into a telephone booth. They had contests, you know, then another one, So that's not natural, how many college students can fit inside a telephone booth. Nor is it natural for the soul. But depending upon the person and the circumstance, different things can be explained, you know, by humble persuasion or by hammer.
So both are acceptable approaches depending on the circumstance?
Well, you know, the hammer approach, one has to be really qualified to do it in such a way that the people just don't run away. You know, Prabhupada said, I can speak like this because I'm an old man. No, he's an old man. We can't do like that. We don't have that credential. Even if you're an old man, you know, so people may run the other way just because. But the protection of an innocent through the against the contamination of impure sound vibration is something that responsibly needs to be considered, and then it's, you know, we consider the circumstances. It's the person, and then it's also the other persons who are present. But even if it's one-on-one, you have a variety of options of how to address when something like that comes up. And then in a group setting, you have, you know, it's a little more complex. So part of that situation in a group setting is not only what you say, but how you conduct yourself itself in itself as a lesson for those in the group, besides what you say. There's a composure and demeanor, and the example that you're setting as a facilitator in a Bhakti Viksha group will be instructive to the others in the Bhakti Viksha group. And so the hammer method is most likely not a good method in a Bhakti Viksha group, because unqualified people may imitate and then, you know, not do it nicely and offend and become, like, you know, harsh in varieties of ways besides even that particular way, thinking that's how you do it. That's what the role model showed us. So there's another dimension in the Bhakti Viksha setting. And it also depends on how pushy the proponent of impersonalism gets. If they're like, you know, obnoxious, or, you know, just go on and on and on and on and on, or something, and then you have to, you know, have a strong foot on the brake pedal. And maybe it's, you know, not in the public forum as much as it is a private talk with that person, or something. You know, so there's varieties of things to do, depending upon the time, place, and circumstance. Anything else? Okay. Srimad Prabhupada Ki Jai.
when it comes back to me.
What is she upset?
Huh?